Yeah, I was thinking, reading this stuff, that all roads led to the Quixote.
Oh, I read Quixote about 5 years ago and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've never read it.
Is there a good translation? I mean, one that you, this kind of
Yeah,
the
a good one recent, I think.
good recently.
Maybe Edith Grossman. I might have just pulled a name out of the air, but I'm going to do this first. Where's our chat?
I was just reading a book of Belarusian short stories, like contemporary, and she was writing about Quixote. It came up even in, I mean, these were like just, you know, it wasn't even heavy duty stuff. It was more just like stories about her town and post-Soviet Belarus, and but Quixote made an appearance in one of the stories.
Apparently, Subcommander Marcos of the Zapatistas, Don Quixote was his favorite book. You'd read it constantly.
I think I'm right that the translation that I read most recently was by a woman named Edith Grossman.
Yes, Grossman.
While we were going there, I found myself laughing to myself, thinking of two boys on a playground, and one boy says, "Do you want Shakespeare's memory?" And the other, and then he kicks the other boy in the
Oh.
That's my brilliant thought.
That's a Zen koan. Who would say no to that,
Yeah, so that Grossman translation is right now the 101st books, literary fiction, United States classics on Amazon, and the 260th, I guess, most sold book in contemporary literature and fiction. So I think I remember she had an interview in the Paris Review, because another thing's coming up, that she's got a book called About Translation, I think. A book called, let's see, Why Translation Matters is a book she wrote. And it says, "For Grossman, translation has a transcendent importance." And there's a whole quote there. But I remember, I think, reading an interview with her. 992 pages, is that?
It's a big one, yeah.
Yeah,
But for whatever reason, I think it's really enjoyable. It's really readable. It's not a slog for sure. It's an adventure.
see, I can get it on Kindle here. I want to see if I can, yeah, I mean, let me see here. I'm going to see if I can just see some of her prose and just how, what they. So, Znor, is you feel all roads lead to Quixote? What, can you say more about that? Just from, I mean, just out of curiosity, kind of what.
Yeah, I've got a different translation here.
But that's fine.
Yeah. This one only has 760 pages, but
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, we don't all have to read the same translation, certainly. Let's see here. I just downloaded it. Let me see here. A sample. Let me see if I can get Harold Bloom wrote an introduction to this one.
He's written introductions to almost everything.
Well, he had a like a jacket blurb on this one on
On the Borges, on the
it's a
Borges.
deep pleasure to read the collected fictions of Borges and Andrew Hurley's capable new version.
Well, I've got a book of essays on Borges, and it's edited by Harold Bloom with an introduction.
Let's see. Dennis, just if, in case you were curious. You still there, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm just eating some ice cream.
You bet.
some pumpkin cheesecake ice cream.
Don Quixote. Don Quixote.
Yeah, it's good business.
39 hours and 35 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Whatever.
We've I am like in. I am down.
Hour ones. This doesn't even matter anymore.
The Quixote.
I think it's a great idea.
I'm with Lacey.
There's
I've
a,
never read it before.
Me neither.
Yeah. Me neither.
Awesome. All right.
Lacey, sorry, I said your name earlier. I'm sorry.
What?
I think I called you Lucy. Maybe if I did, I just wanted to apologize to you.
I don't think you did.
Okay, I didn't. Okay.
I didn't hear it if you did.
Okay.
She's Lucy in another timeline. Yeah, there's a store in Japan, at least in Tokyo. I don't know if it's in other cities, but this chain store called Don Quixote. You get all kinds of strangest things in this store. Anything almost you can find in there. If you wanna get a Trump mask, you would go to Don Quixote to find it.
And then we'll probably end up having to talk about, I think Terry Gilliam tried to make a Don Quixote movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That
There's a documentary about it.
Yeah, there's a documentary about him not being able to finish it.
Yeah.
But he did. But I think it's coming out now. Like he returned to the project.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
really? It's like got a release date. Let's see here.
He would do that. That sounds right.
Yeah, here, his play, IndieWire, is set for U.S. release in, let's see here, finally bound for U.S. release. It came out, it says here, after years of stuff and starts, near misses and almost disasters, legal snafus and financial mishaps, his plague passion project, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, is finally bound for a U.S. release. Maybe we could just watch the movie. March 2019.
Wow.
Well, it's going to be timely then, our discussion.
Huh. Well, don't cheat, okay, guys? I don't know. So, like, with a book like that, I wonder... It's kind of like Moby Dick or... Anna Karenina, where once you take out, like, if there's like so much like strange diversions where you just go off on these weird tangents. I don't know. I'm curious. I'm excited. This is great.
By strange tangents, you meant that
like whale history, you know, like,
oh, okay.
So like Moby Dick is really long and really boring, and you can do, like, if you just take the, like, all the boring parts out and you just have the action, which is kind of what you end up with the movie, you know, it doesn't seem like you miss out on part of the adventure.
Mm.
Because there's something that the boringness conveys about the journey. Like, I'm not kidding. Have you read Moby Dick before?
Yeah, I didn't find it boring at all, though. But
I mean, it's like he really gets into the nuts and bolts of like whale taxonomy.
Yeah,
but like you go to museums and you talk about this whale is called a something fish, but it's not really a fish. You know, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all this stuff, the I love the stuff on whale oil, as that was the, at one point, that was the major source of lighting in people's houses.
Yeah.
And
blubber oil. Yeah.
You didn't find it boring? I thought he did. I thought he did it on purpose.
Made it boring on purpose?
Yeah. To convey how boring it is to be at sea when nothing's happening. You're waiting for action. So you have to go off into your mind and think about the intricacies of spermaceti.
Maybe I do that. I was reading also somewhere else. I think that they're saying whale oil lamps give off the most kind of magical form of lighting. You know.
Wow.
Should be interesting to test out. I had a chance to eat whale meat yesterday, but I didn't. whale sashimi.
Oh yeah, Japan.
Seems like it's your traditional oil lamp used by Arctic peoples, the Inuit and others. Anyway, that's a whole nother, you know, area of exploration, just with like The Shining. Sorry, I'm just thinking about The Shining too. Oh, are we going to have a show on that? I know there was some discussion of that in the email. Maybe a Shining talk, or is that...
Dennis and I were wondering if the moment has passed us by.
Yeah. Though there can be other moments. You know, I don't know. I don't.
What about a film?
Yeah, I do think we should do that.
You guys, is that still?
Hey, Zenor, have you seen Heredity?
Hereditary.
What did I say? Yeah. Have you seen Hereditary?
No, I haven't.
Oh, jeez.
You got to see it.
I haven't.
It's pretty nuts.
I haven't come across it even.
Doug, have you seen that?
When is it from?
Last year. Just last year, yeah.
Hereditary.
It's good. It's really excellent.
It's insane. It's pretty nuts.
There's another movie I just saw that I think would be, it's Kubrickian, and this director, he's got a couple of movies, but one of them, it's called The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Did you guys see that?
Oh, I almost watched that the other day, yeah.
His movies, I guess in the Oscar hunt, The Favorite, but that movie is, you should watch it, Dennis, definitely.
I will. I'll watch it this week, yeah.
It's a companion piece to Hereditary, and there's some similar scenes. Yes, absolutely. Oh,
jeez.
And it's got great acting.
I almost couldn't finish that movie because that movie is dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Saw it twice in the theater. Crazy. It changes your. It's definitely one you get the heebie-jeebies from.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
It's a horror movie.
Yeah,
but that
really
doesn't
is.
Even do it. Like that's such a broad stroke. I would use other nouns. Other genre.
It has a shining quality. It's got a lot of layers, you know, and it's a lot of cult
yeah. Cult horror, maybe it might be a better, more subgenre.
I think that was the same director who did The Lobster. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I wanted to see that.
Sacred Deer is the same director that did The Lobster. Hereditary is a different director.
Hereditary is the one that you saw multiple times in the theater, SJ?
Yes. And the one that Dennis is David Plate's been raving about it.
Too scary. Oh, yeah, I can't watch that. No way.
Don't let your kids see that movie.
Well, no, I can't watch it.
Hereditary is You're saying that it's too scary to watch.
That's what I'm saying. It looks scary. Okay.
It is.
I'm not Googling anything. I'm just you guys talking about it. I'm not going to see that one.
That's going to shake your foundations. I mean, I'm a guy who can watch things and be cool. And I was fine. I saw it twice, but definitely lingers for like an hour of like, am I okay? Am I?
Yeah.
Am I
okay? Yeah.
Okay. You know.
I brought it up at a party of just very normal people, and I realized really quickly, I was like, oh, I wish I would never didn't bring that up, because I don't want these people to see this movie.
You know? Especially in Iowa, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you can say about it without giving it away? Or
I don't want to give a lot away.
Yeah. It's one of the ones you can't really... Like,
you can't say anything. Okay.
No, it's better just to not know anything. Okay. I knew nothing except that people were saying, or I saw ads and I saw some people saying great movie, like a review, like a star review or something. But I knew absolutely nothing about it other than people were saying it was good.
Yeah, and SJ, me too. I hadn't even watched the trailer or anything. And
I hadn't either. I hadn't seen anything. And I went in and it just, I mean, it is a wild ride. I would advise you to do the same.
I'm just looking it up here and I'm just like scrolling through and somebody said, I finally watched Hereditary and oh dear God, will I ever sleep again?
Yeah.
Other movies out. There's one I want to throw out that I don't think gives anything away, but that I think is intriguing, that will might pique your interest, but that won't really give anything away. But I'm even hesitant to do that because it's too, I don't want to give any hint, so I won't do that. But
so
all I'll say is that, yeah, go ahead.
I'm wondering, I just watched the trailer and... Mm-hmm.
The trailer gives a lot away. I don't know. I was surprised. I saw the trailer the other day.
It looks too scary, but if it's a horror film and that it's speaking to some larger something, you know, like...
Yeah.
Is it just nihilistic madness? Yeah,
nihilistic madness.
Not really. I don't think so.
It speaks to the heart of our collective identity. And it goes to the heart of that in a really direct way, and the heart of our cultural identities, let's just say. So no, it's not out. That's what I'm saying. Horror is kind of a misnomer in the sense that it's quite applicable and quite embedded in our, you know, just our reality or in our culture at large. That's why it's so scary, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I want to like list three movies. One I definitely couldn't list. Another one I decided that I can't list. Now the next one I can't even say. This is how.
Wait! You're telling us about movies.
I'll text you.
I'll text you,
Dennis, because you've
seen. Okay,
it.
Please. Yeah.
I want to know too.
I do too.
I think you should just tell us.
No. Okay. I'll say the one. This is the one that I think is the least likely to give anything away. Being John Malkovich. There's some similarities to that
sure.
film.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yes. So you're going to, okay, if you mention these three movies
that are referenced or similar to, or
yeah, if I listed all three, it would give everything away.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I understand. So don't say it. That makes sense. I thought you meant three other movies that you were.
I did too for a second. Yeah.
No, I can't even say the title. It'll give too much away.
I can't suggest the title of the suggestion.
That could be a story.
But that one's a totally different genre. But so you know, that's why it's less threatening to mention.
Yeah.
That might just intrigue you. What does he mean? What the fuck's he talking about? Yeah. So.
And then, SJ, you sent me the trailer to that Velvet Buzzsaw movie, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you send that to me?
I haven't seen that. Yeah, I did send that to you, and I thought of you just because it's the art world.
Yeah. That movie doesn't look very good, but it's funny subject matter. Or interesting subject matter.
I finally watched I finally watched Donnie Darko, which I
I
don't know why I watched, but it was all right. Like, it didn't entirely blow me away or anything, but it was okay. That was one that people have been talking about that for a long time.
Yeah,
I hadn't gotten around to.
I think that one, it's like what I would call the Bardo years, from like 1999 to 2000, where it's like great, this 9/11.
Yeah.
Where some people, have you seen these theories online? This like came out like 2 weeks before 9/11, Donnie Darko, which is, I think, part of the energy behind it.
Okay.
But there's these, and I'm not agreeing with these theories, but there's like a more and more of a movement of people thinking that... It was 2012. Some people say we died in 2012.
In 2012,
But others are saying that this, the 2001, I mean, it's the obvious marker. I mean, we all, it's just this massive thing. But, you know, things did feel different, certainly. The films were even a little different in many ways. And I think this is this Bardo or this transition moment. Donnie Darko is like right on that edge.
Yeah, I like that. Matrix, same thing there.
Fight Club, Matrix, Truman Show. You can even go maybe, back to 97.
Yeah, maybe Truman Show. Like that's 98, I guess, or something.
The other, what's the movie that David played? We were talking about with him last time with Tom Cruise, where he has the mask.
Yeah.
Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
Truman Show's 98.
Vanilla Sky is a remake of a.
Yeah.
And I think Penelope Cruz is in that one too.
It's a remake of
It's like
it's a Spanish film.
Abra los ojos.
Abre los ojos. Open your eyes.
The Royal Tenenbaums. That's got to be on the list. Harry Potter. Is that the first one that came out? The magic.
Oh yeah. The Philosopher's Stone, or the Sorcerer's Stone.
Amelie, Training Day, the sink powerhouse. No, just that's a joke. I mean, I'm sure there's AI. Hello, talking about Penelope Cruz.
This is a movie that comes quite a bit later, but Enter the Void is a total Bardo film. It's all about the Bardo. But that's up to 2009.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's time for bed.
Okay.
Yeah. What time is it, Doug?
It's 11 o'clock in Boise.
Yeah, it's 11 o'clock. Midnight here.
Okay. And in Georgia?
10 a.m. So.
At 10 in the morning, okay.
Just gonna get out and do some stuff, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I had some friends that went there not too long ago and really liked it. And I in like 2004, I was in Croatia and I was hanging out with a girl who had just got done doing Peace Corps in Georgia.
Georgia's great. I mean, I'm walking around, it's like Lower Manhattan. It's like Alphabet City. I mean, it's just some of these neighborhoods are really European and very, really cheap. I mean, I bought a bag of food for like $5 just at the bakery right at the corner of my street. Multiple pastries,
nice.
Like cheese, potatoes, and cakes. And I mean, it's so. Anyhow, I recommend it so far. Maybe I'll have another.
Eat your root vegetables. Eat your root vegetables.
We need to do like a some kind of film that's gonna spur some kind of really in-depth, like financial, political, economic type conversation about stuff.
Yeah.
Michael Clayton, have you seen that movie?
I like that movie.
Yeah, I own that. I watch it like once a year. It's really good.
I don't think I've seen that.
What do you mean, Doug?
Well, nobody came to our Barry Lyndon talk, but we ended up.
I'm sorry, I wanted to come too.
I'm sorry too. I watched it, and oh, fuck.
But I've been thinking, I'm reading Douglas Rushkoff's newest book, and so I'm thinking about political structures and intention and economics and the future.
Yeah.
Network, the Paddy Chayefsky movie, that's, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
That could go there.
Is that the one? I'm sorry.
What is that noise? What is that scraping noise?
I gotta say, that's Dennis doing something.
Oh, I'm walking around. Yeah, maybe it was me.
I'm just wondering what kind of movie.
I didn't know if it's like his pencil or if it's just his mic that's rubbing around on a shirt collar.
Yeah, it was in my shirt, and I was walking in a circle on this rug.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
But is there like a name you can throw out, Doug, of a movie that might get at the kind of themes you're thinking about that can give us a sense of where you're going?
Well, so like the movie The Big Short, did you guys see that one?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah.
That kind of gets it in the neighborhood because it turns like reality into speculation where, I mean, we talked a little bit about that, Znor, where... Mm. It was about front running, where it's just fast computers, because it's not about you can extract value from. And in that case, it was the market itself, just by, like, having the fastest computer nearest the market itself, you can see what the people are doing and then do it before they do it and actually make just a little bit of money. You could game.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Game. It's called arbitrage.
Yeah.
But I mean, if that's your genre, we've got a lot of movies. There's classics. There's like The Wolf of Wall Street. You could go that route. You could go American Hustle. You could go what's the classic movie Boiler Room? That's a big
Boiler Room.
Znor and I also talked about Slavoj Žižek and the idea of
he is coming up everywhere right now.
Really, we were talking about like the kind of political. Znor is holding out for his anarchist miracle.
I heard you guys having that chat. I heard that. That was a good chat. But
the anarchist miracle is ongoing, so you don't need to hold out for it.
Yeah, you don't need to hold it.
Well, I think it's the same as Nabokov's Radical Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Texture of time.
I don't know. It's probably, yeah, we're more of it's the Bardo where we're all in hell, right?
heaven realm? I don't know. We could watch The Secret. No, I'm just kidding. We could read and watch The Secret and just have, no, I'm just. American Hustle. Is that one?
I don't. All those movies suck, though.
I was going to say that.
I don't. But I know. I know. I hear your intention. But
what? Why do you want to talk about that stuff, Doug?
Because I feel like there are times when. We talk about, you know, we like break the world up into chunks and say, look at over here and look at over here. And then there are these other moments when you realize that all these chunks are all related and it's the core operating system that's at fault, say. Mm. So like, I think we talked about student loan debt maybe a little bit, or maybe we talked like an environmental crises a little bit, and it seems like money and capitalism are doing exactly what they're programmed to do. But I don't know how you, like, there's no reset button for that because it's working correctly. I don't know how you dream up a new operating system.
Well, isn't that something that Zizek said, that it's easier for people, I don't know if it was him or somebody else, but it's easier for people to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism?
Yes. Yeah.
I've heard that.
Or it's easier, and I just read that, it's easier to imagine like environmental collapse than to imagine capitalism doing anything about it.
Right. it's so tricky to talk about this stuff, though, because people have such varied definitions on these terms, like capitalism, yeah, and the free market and socialism and communism, and any term like that you come up with, that people have got different takes on what these things mean.
So in Douglas Rushkoff's previous book, it's called Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. And so he's talking about this moment in the Renaissance when the merchant class was using like market script to trade, but the currency itself would lose value. And so you needed, over the course of the market, and then some of these things are perishable. And so it caused you, they weren't storage mediums, you know, you really needed to spin this stuff or else you would lose value, right? But what it did was it built this merchant class because it was making them wealthy through these peer-to-peer connections. And then the nobles said, this is stupid. We need to reconsolidate all this power. You know, and so they, like, you clamp down, and then all of a sudden it's the realm of the realm of the coin. Or the coin of the realm, excuse me. And so that's where you dream up this idea of interest, or, you know, like, so you put this currency into production, and, you know, people have to pay it back with interest, but the interest requires infinite growth, right? That's the thing that we're talking about.
Right.
That is so tricky to deal with. But then, like, capitalism, I think the way I would talk about it has more to do with this idea of the shareholders. So, like, the stock and the fiduciary responsibility to grow the company for the shareholders, say. Mm. You know?
Yeah, that's they're legally bound to do their best to
make money, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's why. Yeah.
Like, so hey, listen to this. Listen to this.
Listen to this.
Because Doug, I mean, it's funny how we're all thinking about the same things just through slightly different lenses. So okay. This artist that I've been thinking a lot about, he's local here in Iowa City, but his family is from Argentina. His father was a very famous artist. They all were printmakers. And so their last name is Lozansky, and the grandfather was really famous for having made these Nazi etching prints that were very famous, and they do a lot of, like, really interesting prints of, like, Lincoln and stuff. I don't know. It's a lot of, it's not all my bag, but they're so smart about how they do their business. So and they have, like, this incredible studio where it's two of the uncles and now one of a grandson. And then the grandfather was also this famous printmaker, but they, you know, they'll trade prints for, like new appliances, or they will trade, they will offer like a newer print and take back several older prints from collectors. And like the CEO from Google just flew in to their studio recently and bought a bunch of stuff, and they'll take money in cash. And not, I mean, there's like, but their economic plan is
is so smart on so many levels. I was having a conversation with this guy who's the head of this other big business, and I was just like, how did they learn this, you know? And but it shows how ignorant like we are about economy sometimes, because you know, they've made this, and it's a print, so they're printmakers, so they're making multiples of something. It had a lot of relation to currency, if you ask me, and like even derivative markets and stuff. But like, yeah.
It just reminds me, Dennis, you're talking about this is, so when you go into these areas, inevitably this is where it goes, like usury, people that control the money supply. And obviously, I mean, I don't even want to bring a religion or ethnicity into this, so I'm going to leave that out. But just these, you know, these are generational skills that are passed down with certain families.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what
I said to my friend. I was like, how did they know this? Like, and I just was impressed by the smartness of, I don't know. I didn't find this to be an exploitative scenario. Like, I actually thought it was like really impressive that you can have something that you're offering that can be offered in so many different various ways. But go ahead, SJ.
I mean, I was just making a point that, yeah, on the topic of this general topic of like money and oppression and things like this, I think you eventually get to these historical development of cat money, like Doug was talking about, the Catholic Church introducing usury, leaving it to the realms of other kind of non-sanctioned groups to do usury. But I think that I was just raising two points to that point, which we could talk about, but then this other point that some of these skills are passed down through generations.
Yeah.
And the corollary is that some of the, like, these skills are removed from certain groups, but through generations, like my families, you know, they're just, you know, we're raised to be teachers and just kind of workers in the community. And, you know, I went to public schools. There was no like how to master the money system classes or anything like that. It's just kind of your average. Mm-hmm. Kind of sheeple education, you know, aside from the hardcore psychedelics and then pulling a Voorhees, you know, at a young age. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I think these are embedded institutional conditioning processes. And it sounds like this family you've described has a family history of these skills, and they've been doing it for a long time.
It made me think, I've done in the past, I've like sold a big piece and just taken a cash, you know, and so not declare it, you know, and avoid, you know, certain tax, you know, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
But don't report me, Doug. But you know, like if I was thinking about this in relation to like, you know, increased digital currencies and such, and like that's going to eliminate all of these like barter class in a way. I don't know. Maybe it's either eliminates it or it creates the exact same scenario. But like everything, when everything's tracked, you don't get to do, you know, I don't know. It just made me think of what it eliminates or potentially eliminates.
I think
does anybody follow me there?
When PayPal started, there was something. I think it was too near banking, and they were asked to not do that. Like they were, and so they had to change their business model.
That's bullshit, because they're totally doing that, you know. I don't know.
Well, it's the whole thing. So, like, General Electric learned
early
on that they made more money lending money than making washers, and so then there was that branch that really took the company into the next.
Yeah, or McDonald's having the real estate, the land being more valuable than
the franchise.
Yeah, Lenin's having the real estate empire. You know, another.
The interesting thing, SJ, is I'm saying that if that is just the tenet of like the computer program, say, then there doesn't have to be any overt controlling body above, because it's just everything's working the way it's supposed to. Like, it just, you know, money slash the capitalistic tenants are just functioning, and they're producing results for those who are able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also don't think it's just like an energy of in nature that is operating independently of human interference. I mean, I would argue that, in fact, the opposite, that the controllers of the monopoly of violence, the people on top of that kind of schema, have passed legislation and regulation on a daily basis that actually enforces those monopolistic effects.
Sure.
And I'm not coming from like a libertarian. I mean, I'm setting aside any advocacy of any political system here. I'm just saying, like, we know, for example, like the student loan crisis is a result of bankruptcy laws that were passed through the course of like a 20-year period, and regulations that guaranteed the expansion of that balance sheet. Or another example would be the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy has a direct implication of on the growth of financial assets, for example, since the crash, because they had zero interest rates. So all I'm saying is there are choices made by individuals that wield power, and I think that there's a robust critique there. And I'm not even saying that that would elbow out this other model of just kind of things happening in nature. I think that's a valid point, and that's certainly applicable.
Well, I'm not saying, like, nature, because I think nature is more collaborative. Like our human nature is to be sharing and collaborative. And there's something really, like, not human or toxic about the system. I almost want to think of it like the Matrix, because it is, it's alien, or it's robotic.
Tillian? sorry.
Robotic, or, yeah, not human. So,
yeah.
Because infinite growth is just so crushing, where, like, I think you realize that in the last 50 years, the wages of, you know, the middle class haven't changed at all. But then, you know, you go up the scale and you see that, you know, it's increased like crazy for people on the other end of the spectrum. Maybe it's 100 years or 80 years or something. I don't know.
It just, 1970 was the moment you could trace. Yeah.
It just gets hard. Like, Doug, we were talking last time about Ezra Pound, right? And then his sort of journey of trying to find out how the system worked, and then how he kind of derailed himself by looking into, like, what SJ was saying, like, that there are different groups and ethnicities who have historically had to, like obviously Pound's talking about the Jews, right? But if you look into the history of the Jews, it's like they weren't allowed to own property, and so they're kind of, in a way, they're kind of pushed into the money market.
Yeah.
But then that's how Pound derailed himself. It's kind of like a fixed channel for us to get swept off into, like, to blame it on a certain group of people, instead of seeing it as just this group of people happens to be the mafia in charge during a certain period of history, you know. And in other periods of history, there have been other mafias, and even now, it's not just the Jewish mafia. It's like the Anglo-Saxon mafia and whoever, the Russian mafia, and all kinds of different mafias.
Just to say quickly on that point too, Znor, I mean, there's actually writers that posit it's really a Catholic conspiracy, because they wanted to integrate usury, and so they picked one ethnicity to kind of be the take the blame,
and
shift the focus. The other thing is that India, you know, there's many different ethnic groups in India, and there's actually certain ethnicities, or they have names, that were assigned those same tasks to do, like, financial and interest and things.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
Just to underscore your point, this is a, it's like a it's not about one group. This is actually a larger principle that we seem to kind of assign these ethnic tasks, let's say.
Yeah, and there's other groups that are assigned other unsavory tasks, like butchering and things like that in countries like
India
and other places in the East, where these become the untouchable people, you know, the people who have to directly do the killing of the animals that everybody else eats, you know. But yeah, so same thing, like that makes sense that that whole sort of usurious part of the system gets assigned as well.
Yeah, and I like to think about.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry,
I just say the principle. It's like you hate the behavior, you love the person. I mean, this is like a kind of a New Age spiritual idea that I've always liked. It's like, you know, like I can love someone but dislike the behavior. And so, you know, it really is for me, like when I critique, and I don't single out one group or anything, but I mean, I just critique this system that we've created, you know, I mean, yeah. It's like, and there may be disproportionate, this ethnicity is maybe disproportionately involved, but to me, that's just, it's more about, let's try to make changes that are ethnic neutral, that are about like, you know, changing the structure, if that makes sense, if that's even possible, but that's sort of my
I don't think it's possible. I don't know how you would.
You might say something like, "We're going to have a public central bank that is non-usurious," and so I mean, I'm talking about radical, just in the realm of what's radical.
That's get presidents get shot over that.
No, I know, but I mean, it's just like that is a ethnic neutral.
As close as I can get is like on if you're one of the people at the farmer's market. They all are trading their shit all day long.
Yeah.
And having a good, you know, it's like my farmer friend comes home with all these new beers and he's spread his spinach around and, you know, it's it seems like.
No, you're right. I used the example of that art and print are in printmaking earlier, but you could very well use the farmer's market as the same type of a good point, Doug.
But that's the thing too. Like that, it could go that way as well. Like people really like cryptocurrencies and see that as the way forward. But the cryptocurrencies themselves, if you've got dollars, you can get bitcoins, right? So any bank who can produce money out of nothing can flood the Bitcoin market.
Well, that's what happened, too. Yeah, and so it became speculation.
So the other way is this kind of these radical barter networks, which through the internet makes completely possible as well, you know? That seems to be the more radical path.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I hear that. I think the idea that maybe is more feasible, and I'm definitely someone for like radical visioning, but I mean, we have this state apparatus and you know, I like one example I like is in the reparations debate. You have just different debates, but one of the, you know, the advocacies, this guy, Lewis Gossett, he's a professor at Harvard. He says, listen, the way you do reparations is you just have a race neutral policy of eliminating poverty. And so rising tide lifts all boats. Those groups that are disproportionately harmed will be disproportionately benefited from these kind of policies. And I think, you know, I think there is a vision of, and maybe this is totally naive and a utopian, you know, pipe dream, but of having, I guess let me put it this way, we have to be organized some way. I mean, there's going to be organization. It's inevitable. And especially in the age of the internet and when you have weapons of mass destruction, I mean, I just have a hard time thinking that there isn't going to be a state apparatus, and you know, and maybe that's, you know, and I don't know, but if I had to bet, I would say the state is probably going to exist. So if we can somehow make the state bend to the kind of anarchic vision, and that is to say things like a public central bank and income for all, like, or jobs for all. Like I was just in Belarus. I mean, everybody works. You wake up and there's just people sweeping the streets everywhere. I mean, if you want a job, you just go. I mean, you have to have certain papers. I was talking to my friend, but you basically just go sign up. And it's the cleanest city. It's the third cleanest city in the world. And so, I mean, these kind of radical models where you never want, and there's always something to do, and you just go get in line and you get your assignment. And I think there's something to the Soviet and communist style vision. Now, setting aside all the, you know, the 60 million, that's a joke, but I mean, I just think there's something to do with the state, and there might be a role for the state. Anyhow, that, and I'm not even convinced at that point. I'm just throwing it out because I, you know, I think there's some good arguments for the state that we would want to maybe try to have a counter argument to, or deconstruct a little bit, or you know.
I used to live in Laos, which is a communist country. Like, it's the governing party is communist, but in that country, because they haven't allowed the big corporations to come in, the big multinational corporations to come in, then everybody's got a shop in their own like backyard, like their back kitchen is a shop, and so it's like it's more free market than any other place I've been to, supposedly communist.
You're seeing this a little bit in the art community in terms of artist-run spaces that are small and maybe even in a backyard, like you said.
So I was just out with my friend just the other day, and he's basically right-wing libertarian style, I guess, you know. But when he would say socialism, he would mean something completely different than what I would mean. And when I said capitalism, it meant something completely different to him. You know, just to get the term straight. Is the biggest thing first, you know, to even have that conversation.
Absolutely.
Because
no one's doing that.
Yeah. It's yeah. Yeah, yeah. No one's even taking the time to try to find a common ground with that, you know.
But everybody's talking about these issues. No one's getting the term straight, and it's just emotional kind of projection. I mean, that's why America is so heavy duty with, and now a new election cycle. I mean, it's happening. Like, this point is a key point, Snor, because I feel for myself. I mean, all of us, we're in the discourse. We're going to be subjected to it if we log in, you know.
Well, one point he was making is like, he was saying that the right wing does not exist, you know. There is no more right wing, that the entire political spectrum has shifted so far to the left that you can't call anything right anymore. And then I was saying the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Right? I was saying the exact opposite, right? Like I was saying, like, Bernie Sanders is, yeah, like Eisenhower was as radical as Sanders is now, you know. Like and Sanders is supposed to be the most radical guy out there, but I could see his point, you know. I could see the point he's making, and we sort of we came to the conclusion we're basically talking about the same thing using completely different terms.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how we could say it shifted to, I mean, for me, like the idea that everything's so far left, like I just didn't.
He's talking culturally, right? So he's saying he's using like the 1950s sense of the nuclear family and what is it? What's the classic line? The women in the kitchen, blacks in their place, and gays in the closet, you know.
I've never heard that. That's crazy.
I know, but that's the 1950s ideal, right? Like that's
but the country definitely has become more progressive, but at the same time there's like all the, it seems like the business of the country, both parties kind of agree for the most part. Like maybe the left wants to spend a little more on social programs, and the right thinks part.
But the focus now is so much on culture, right? And this guy, my friend, is a big conspiracy theorist, like deep conspiracy, and he thinks that the the very highest elite, what their aim is complete cultural social modification, right? So they want the family to completely break down, and they want everybody to be gay or whatever, you know. Like the, so in that sense, I see where he's coming from, why he thinks that
I think
the,
our technology, if there's a breakdown, it's our technology is...
That's what I argued with him as well. It comes from the technology.
Because it's making us antisocial. We're just like...
Yeah.
Scrolling our feeds, man. I got to go to bed and scroll my feed.
Well, it's really interesting. I just think because I see a case for this kind of right-wing... hardcore oligarchic capitalism that would deploy kind of, for lack of a better term, and I don't mean to offend anybody, so-called SJW mores in service of its kind of dominance, full-spectrum dominance, let's say. And you see this in writers like Pasolini and others that talk about the kind of the new market for capitalism as the interiority and identity.
Yeah.
And so maybe there, and I think the other component could be like a transhuman expansion where you have tech companies that are now, I just saw a meme that was going online that showed like Rockefeller, JP Morgan and some of the others. And it said the new robber barons, and it was Jack from Twitter, Zuckerberg, and then the two founders of Google. But this idea that, I mean, the information and the technology is so profitable. I mean, those are the biggest companies in the Fortune 500 by market cap. It's all the big tech companies. Mm. But in order to get the technology embedded into the body, let's say, like the Internet of Things, is not just the fingers, what we push, but it's actually the heartbeat and even the thoughts. I mean, these become monetized.
Perception in itself, right?
This could be a right wing, if you want to look at it in terms of right wing oligarchic capitalism. That was just the phrase I invented, because I do consider that kind of right wing, you know, that there could be a case for that. But I do think you really have to be careful and parse this out in a way that it gets complicated too, because as people look, let's be real. The majority of us are going to be social engineered, let's say. Okay, that's inevitable. And what am I going to do? Am I going to love other people as I see them maybe making choices that I wouldn't make, let's say? Of course I am. I want to love everybody, you know, and I'm not, you know, and so it's a really difficult, these are like, there's paradox, there's contradiction. It's very difficult. If we're going to go here conversationally, it takes a lot of time to flesh this nuance out and really massage it in a way that, you know, because I come in peace for everybody, and sometimes talking about this stuff, you can really trigger people, or
exactly,
you know. And most people are good people. I mean, most people, even like the, what I would call quote unquote dem bots, and that's a pejorative. I don't call people that usually because I don't want to be pejorative. But let's just say mainstream Democrats, like a Hillary supporter, for example. You know, I think that there's a hard critique of that, right, from the left, like militarism, the Libya situation, deaths, blood on her hands, all of this stuff. At the same time, do I think you're at the average Hillary supporter that I knew in 2016? They're good people. They have good hearts. They actually want good things. It's a question of what someone believes will achieve those ends. That's where the miscommunication happens and the lack of understanding. Mm. And we all have different belief systems. Like, I'm not right. I know that, you know. And so it can be very tough, let's just say, to like throw stones in this realm. And it's hard. It's just hard. What do you do? And at the other hand, it's like, well, if there's bodies on the ground, millions of them, I mean, you should be in the street, right? And doesn't that make sense? Get in the street. Yellow vests. Let's pull a yellow vest. There's dead Yemenis right now. You know, so sorry to get heated, but I mean, how do you, you know, it's just, anyhow, I feel kind of hopeless about it all, the politics. That's a long way of saying that. I don't see change coming. There's no, the times are not a changing. You know, well,
that's the biggest thing is the quality of time. That's why it doesn't quite, it's not something that you can completely rationalize, right? Like, why are some periods of history so revolutionary and things just change overnight, and then other times it seems impossible that anything could change, right? But like I know in my own life, I've gone through certain cycles, right? Like you can sort of see it, like early 90s, there was this kind of this big push for the environment, and a lot of people got out in the street. People were really ecologically conscious, and then that kind of died down, and then another wave came up with the anti-globalization. Movement, maybe another wave now with the yellow vest thing. So it's like how do you map that? You know, there's kind of this strange alchemy of social
the
movements
planets,
that goes on.
Planets,
yeah, that's well, people said maybe it's the sunspot cycles, right? This 11-year cycle mm-hmm. of the sun. But I think there's a cycle in consciousness too, whether or not. How that's reflected otherwise.
But, well, Saturn's ingress into Gemini in early 2001. Okay, no, I'm sorry. But I mean, yeah, there's all, yeah, I mean, I do think that there is transcendent cycles that the planets have something to do with, not that the planets are necessarily causing it, but they might just be symbolic representations of these
kind
of deeper patterns.
Yeah, that's right. They're like the hour hands or the minute hands on a clock, right? They just show what psychic time it is, basically.
It's like what Voorhees wrote about, these kind of ripples that are maybe repeating, you know, and I don't know. I know for me that the other component to this is worth interjecting with or injecting in here is the idea of personal politics of my personal sphere. Like, how do I treat myself mm-hmm. with my thoughts and my actions? And how do I treat the people around me? Like, I think that is... extremely important and almost maybe more important in some ways, because I do believe that like acts of kindness have a ripple quality.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
they reverberate, you know? And it's, so I think that's for me almost a more important question. Like maybe let's call it the spiritual side or,
it's almost foundational. You can't escape the self, right? So all these other things that we can talk about are kind of abstractions, right? But these day-to-day things we do, our interactions and movements and gestures and what we say to people, those are primary.
Doug, are you still here?
Yes.
I'm just curious because I don't have kids. Snor, you have some kids, right?
But it's 3:45 in the afternoon, and my mother-in-law's here, so that's takes a load off.
But like, and Dennis has kids, so you guys all have kids, and I know that I'm kidless, so I mean I can kind of be more. I think with kids, I guess what I'm gonna ask you guys. I mean, do you feel more of a sense of like that the political as it's offered in our society is a valid egress? And a valid kind of realm of action, such that change can be made. Let's say tangible, workable, real change.
Through what? Like through elections and political parties?
Yeah,
elections. Are you talking radical action of the street?
No, I'm talking that what's offered, like the elections, let's say, or
The United States is a battleship. And through the political process, you can move the battleship a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right. And it takes a lot of work. So.
Never wear battleship gray. 10,000 soldiers not trying to board you. Do you remember that, Eddie Murphy?